Thank you. Oh, okay. To finish my talk, today I would like to give some explanation concerning this algorithm of characterization. Excuse me, what? Vitaly Bergersonovich. Okay. So, which actually consists of two main parts. The first part, we actually reduce the problem to characterization, problem of characterization of traces of Sobolev spaces of order two to characterization of the norm of certain gradient mapping in the space which sum of the Sobolev space of order one in R2 plus certain LP weighted space in R2. And whenever we know how to characterize this norm, we obtain various algorithms for characterization of traces of Sobolev two functions on R2. But today I would like to discuss this first part of the algorithm. So actually, second part, we'll discuss it in the two previous lectures. So here's the main result, which we'll discuss this lecture. We have a finite set E in R2. Let K be a family of paralyzed disjoint squares, and let delta be a mapping which every square from this family assigns a triangle with vertices in the set E. Let me make a picture. A triangle with vertices in set E. Say this one. Delta K, such that it lies in certain fixed dilation of the square K, say gamma K, and its diameter of delta equals to the diameter of K. The family of all centers of these squares from the family K, we denote by CK. This is element of the set C, capital K. So we have a lot of squares with certain centers and corresponding triangles with vertices in the set E. And we have a family of centers of these squares. They are first settings. Then this pair, the family of squares and the family of corresponding triangles delta K, generate certain measure, which we denote by mu K delta, which can be defined as follows. The subset of this measure is the family of centers of the squares from K. So outside of this family, the measure is zero. And for each point, for each center of corresponding square K, the point CK, to the measure of this one-point set is precisely the Menger curvature of the square Q to the power P times measure square Q, square K, sorry. We continue. Formulation of the theorem. Now, every function F defined on this finite set E, every pair of paralyzed disjoint squares K and corresponding triangle delta generate the so-called gradient mapping tau, which has the same support. Outside of the set of centers is zero, centers of squares from K. And for every CK, the value of this mapping is precisely the gradient of the polynomial of degree at most one, which interpolates function F on the vertices of the triangle K. This is our definition. And now we define the sum of the vector space L1P, vector space, Sobolev space with two coordinates, And the vector space, also these two coordinates, LP with respect to this discrete measure mu. Okay, now?
You obviously disregard the situation when three points are on the same line, so
yes, we'll see now from this theorem. So we really disregard this in formulation of our theorem. Of course, we have a problem with this interpolating polynomial in this definition. But for the sake of simplicity, today we will disregard this. This difficult day. So the main theorem states that let E be a finite subset of R2, which does not contain triples of collinear points. P straightly greater than 2 and less than infinity, and F is a function defined on E, then the norm of the trace norm of the function F in the trace space L2PR2 to E can be calculated as follows. We actually simply take the supremum of these gradient mappings, of the norms of these gradient mappings in the sum, corresponding sum of L1P vector in R2 and corresponding weighted LP space. Whenever this supremum is taken over all family scales, Bayesian joint squares, and all mappings delta satisfying these properties from the definition. This is the main result. So, again, we fix a family, we fix certain squares, certain triangles, we calculate the norm of this gradient mapping in the sum, so optimal decomposition of this gradient mapping into Sobolev vector function and remainder LP mu function, and taking the supremum, we obtain the something which is equivalent to the norm of M in the vector. The previous page can be seen much more simply. So, this is the previous page. I'm sorry, I need a lot of pictures, so let me, for convenience. It's okay? It's okay now, so?
Yes, the thing is, the gradient mapping is a vector.
Is a vector. Yes, we are in vector Sobolev space with two coordinates and a vector LP space. So we can, of course, can check each coordinate separately, but it's convenient.
And just to clarify, and I think we discussed this right, your proof actually shows much more, right? It actually exhibits a family, a particular family K delta, which depends only on the set E.
Charlie, this is the second part of my talk, very, very detailed. So, no, not so. It's a very natural question. Do we have something which we can construct and which does not depend on function f? We'll do this on the second part of this lecture, maybe. Maybe too late. Okay, so this is my aim to demonstrate this algorithm. This is the result. So, this is actually rather important part of our algorithm because we actually reduce the problem from factorization of Sobolev W2 functions to characterization of the norm in the sum L1P plus something, but this is L1, it's not L2. And we have seen in the previous lecture that rather explicit algorithms to determine this norm in L1P plus weight and changing the criterion, we obtain the new criterion for the Sobolev space and so on. So, let's see the proof of this result in both directions. In both directions, the proof is non-trivial. Even in the simplest direction, which we'll begin with. Let's prove that the right-hand side of this main inequality, so this supremum is bounded by norm of the trace norm function f after some constant. So we have to prove that whenever we have a function f on E and a certain extension of this function to a Sobolev function from L2P R2, and so we have a fixed family of squares and corresponding family of triangles with these properties, we have to prove in this first part of the theorem that the norm of the corresponding gradient mappings in the sum of L1P and corresponding L1 P and corresponding LP space with respect to corresponding measure is bounded by the norm of function F. Instead of norm F, the takes norm of function F, takes the norm of function F capital in L2P, and then to go to the infimum of all these extensions. So we'll do. To prove this inequality, we will use two propositions. Actually, the first proposition is very well known, Sobolev-Poincaré inequality. In this special case of L2P functions, whenever P is strictly greater than 2, let me recall this important for us inequality. It states that whenever F is a C1 function from the Sobolev space L2P, and Q strictly greater than 2, less than or equal to P strictly less than infinity, then for every square Q in R2, the difference between the values of functions, function F, point X and Y. So actually, in this case, we have two inequalities. The difference between the value of function F minus corresponding Taylor polynomial at point Y can be estimated by distance between these two points times this number, and the distance between the gradients can be estimated by this number. This is the variant of Sobolev-Poincaré inequality for W2P function. So we have certain square and two points, and the values of function and corresponding Taylor polynomial of F at this point, the first order, the value of gradients at these two functions, from function F at these two points can be estimated according to these two formulas. So this is the first inequality, the classical estimate of the remainder, and the second one besides the Sobolev-Poincaré inequality for gradients, which is L1P functions, L1P functions on R2. Okay. So this is the first tool which we need in our proof. And using the Sobolev-Poincaré inequality, we now show how the gradient of the arbitrary polynomial of degree 1, which interpolates function f on given three points on vertices of triangle delta, differs from the value of gradient of this function. So this second important proposition 2.2 states that if function f is C1 function from L to P, again Q and P the same, delta is a triangle in R2, which is embedded in a square Q, then gradient, the distance between the gradient of function f of a polynomial P which interpolates f on the vertices of this triangle minus the values of gradient of f at point CQ at the center of the cube can be estimated. This number, of course, from the Sobolev-Poincaré inequality is taken, but this some sort of measure of distortion between these two things, gradient of interpolating polynomial and the gradient of function. We see how they find each other. So we see that here appears the important thing, the radius of the circle passes through the vertices of the triangle, 1 over the radius curvature, and we see some from this point curvature begin to play a certain role in all this proof. Okay, so actually the proof was demonstrated in the previous conference. I have no time now to show this proof. It uses actually Sobolev-Poincaré inequality, both inequalities on there, and can be found in my preprint. Okay. Now using these two results, we are ready to prove the first part of the theorem. The proof is rather simple if we have these two results. So Let us apply and let us fix the family of pairwise disjoint squares, and let us apply. Let me actually. This our square K, this is its center, this is the triangle delta, this vertex is Z1, Z2, Z3, let's say, and we know that gamma dilation of K contains the triangle, but the size of triangle is equivalent to the size of the square K. So let us apply the second proposition to the square Q, which is gamma Q. And by this proposition, the distance between the polynomial which interpolates F on this triangle delta minus the value of gradient at the point CK is bounded by radius of the circle which passes through the point z1, z2, z3, times diameter k over diameter delta k times this number. But in our case, these two guys are equivalent, the diameter of the triangle and diameter of k, so we have a certain simplification of this inequality. We see that this difference can be estimated by constant radius of the circle times this average of the gradient of the second order to the power q. And what we do now, we choose any point y on our square k, and we estimate this average by the values of the maximal function of the second gradient at the point y to the power 1 over q, because this is by definition of the maximal function, it's the standard Hardy-Littlewood maximal function. So we obtain, then we divide both sides by the radius and take the power p, we obtain this inequality that this value can be estimated by the value of maximal function to the power p over q at every point y on k. Then we integrate this inequality over square k over y and obtain that, and we see that on the right left hand side we appears the measure of square k because this is constant, and on the right hand side integral of maximal function corresponding power. Now the integral of the difference tau x minus the gradient of a function f to the power p with respect to measure mu by the definition is precisely sum of all squares k, the difference, no, this is constant, we should take as the center of kt, square k, times this measure. And by this equivalent inequality, this equivalent sum of the measure of integrals of maximal function of all squares k from our family, which is bounded by integrals over all R2 because these squares are bound by the disjoint. Now we apply Hardy-Littlewood maximal theorem. Because p is strictly greater than q, we can take x, say q, something fixed at p plus 2 over 2, for instance. We obtain that what we need. The integral of the difference to the power p is bounded by the norm of function f in the Sobolev space L to p to the power p. This is our inequality which we obtain. So we see that the norm of our mapping t is bounded, this is the optimal decomposition. First component of the decomposition is the gradient, this is the remainder, and for both we have estimate, because this is the gradient of the Sobolev function, this is function from L1p, it is bounded by the norm of the function f, this guy actually is estimated, and that's it. So the proof in this direction, non-elementary, but up to this proposition with difference, which is of course important. Okay, now we begin the proof in converse direction. Actually, we now, my aim is to present the special family of squares and special family of triangles, for which the trace norm is equivalent up to, actually not equivalent, is bounded by some constant dependent on P. The norm of this gradient mapping tau in the sum of corresponding spaces. So let me, instead of proof, to present algorithm. How given a function f bound defined on given set E, we assign an almost optimal extension of this function to a function from L to P in R2. And in this algorithm, we'll see how this family K can be defined. And in this way, we shall prove the theorem. So we begin our construction, which in the natural way can be divided into main parts. The first part of this main, so-called main algorithm, I call pre-work. Which means that in this first part of the main algorithm, we will construct the main geometrical object which we need to for the definition of the extension. One of them will be the family of squares K and triangles. So actually we will prove at the stage of pre-work, we will present a certain triangulation of our set E. Let's see what we do. So what we need. So at the first stage, we defined very standard stuff, Whitney squares, and corresponding the partition of unity for the set E. We have set E. This is the first step. Let me make parallel a picture of corresponding step. We built Whitney squares, a family WE of Whitney squares and corresponding partition of unity subordinated to this family. This is more or less standard. Step two of our algorithm. We construct lacunas, lacunae. That means we characterize certain holes, set E, this set E. This is a family of Whitney squares, which we call a lacuna. We determine all lacunas of the family. And for each lacuna L, we define the so-called bridge. We'll define two sorts of bridges, interior bridges and so-called exterior bridges. Let me explain what I mean. Interior bridge is very simple thing. We know that for every lacuna there is a small island which we call VL. This is intersection of every cube Q, excuse me, not cube, square Q, which belongs to lacuna with the set E. Because of structure of lacuna, we know that intersection does not depend on square, and this is certain small set, subset of E, which we call VL. Yes, even not 10, even 90. You're absolutely right.
This is a Whitney decomposition of the complement of E.
And this decomposition In this decomposition, we determine certain group of Whitney squares, which we call lacuna. For each lacuna, there is this, let me recall that for each lacuna, square Q from lacuna, its intersection with E is the same as intersection of 90 square Q with E. So each lacuna characterizes a certain big hole in, and which contains this small island here, which does not depend on square Q. Elementary lacunas, actually, let me explain. So this is for true lacuna. For elementary lacunas, the situation is much more simpler. And in this true lacuna, for this set VL, we define two points, which we call AL and BL, such that the distance between these two points is equivalent to the diameter of VL. There are several different situations. For instance, VL may be one point. In this case, whenever RVL actually one point, we define L to be this point, and BL the point which is close, the closest to L, AL to the complement of the set. So BL closest to A on E minus AL. But for elementary lacunas, by the definition of an elementary lacuna, we have always we have the two points such that 90 Q with E contains two points ALBL, such this is such that this intersection, diameter of this intersection, equals the distance between these two points. So there is no big difference between true lacuna and elementary lacuna from this point of view. These two points for this pair we call interior bridge, AL, BL, it's called interior bridge of the lacuna. So we have a lot of interior bridges in our set E, certain pairs, which depends on corresponding lacunas on our set E. This is a set. And as a set, certain pairs are chosen to be interior bridges. ALBL, say, maybe here, AL prime, BL prime, and so on. So this is a very simple definition of an interior bridge, and we turn to the next step. Now we would like to construct bridges between lacunas. What do I mean? We know that each lacuna touches finite number of other lacunas. It means that this is step three. We are acquainted with the notion of contacting lacunas. So this means that there is square Q from L and Q prime from L prime such that the intersection of these squares is not empty. We call L and L prime contacting lacunas, Q prime contacting squares. And for instance, we have two contacting lacunas and corresponding interior bridges, AL BL, AL prime, BL prime, for lacuna L and for lacuna L prime. My aim is to connect these two bridges by a certain additional bridge, which I call exterior bridge between these two lacunas, which in a certain special way. So I would like to build Cranmore Bridge, I don't know which one. One end of this bridge in LDL, in the ends of the interval bridge, and the second end in the ends of the second bridge. But we construct this bridge with respect to following the next a bit strange condition. So let me first read this condition, and then I try to explain on the picture. So we wish to choose point CLL prime one end of this exterior bridge and point CL prime L the second end in the following way. In the triangle ALBL CLL prime, it means we take LBL and the end of bridge, say this is C L prime L. We see here a new triangle. Two vertices of the triangle is interior bridge, and the third one is the end of the bridge. So in this triangle, CALBLCLL prime, the side of the triangle which is opposite to the vertex CLL prime, this is vertex CLL prime, this is the first end of the bridge. So the side which is opposite this vertex is not minimal, is not the smallest side of the triangle. This is my a bit strange rule. Eh? So, so I would like to add the additional bridge in such a way that actually my aim is follows. If this is angle alpha corresponding to the end of the bridge, which in the interior bridge, then my aim to find, to build, to construct this bridge in such a way that sinus alpha will be equivalent to the diameter of triangle over radius of the circle which passes over its vertices.
So, quickly, in what you have written there in blue,
yeah,
ALBL
C L prime L. Yes, C L prime L, the next end in this interior. BL and yes,
the side which is opposite,
but not this guy, is opposite to
that guy.
Yes, to that guy, which is the end of bridge, which is this interior bridge.
Oh.
So it's a bit, but the picture is very, it seems to me very explicit. So the same true in this triangle, second triangle, the side which is opposite to CLL prime, this side is not minimal in the triangle. So the unique aim of all this construction to have this property which we use in all our construction, because here we see that we have diameter R delta, which is very important for us further later on. Okay? So we'll see how it works later. But some sort of special way to construct bridges. And now we turn to the next step. So now we have a lot of bridges, interior and exterior, in this set E, say, for this pair. There's this bridge, one more pair, another additional bridge, and so on. So for every two contacting lacunas, we construct corresponding exterior bridge which connects the interior bridges of these two lacunas. Now, using this family of connected bridges, we denote two connected bridges by the sign, We construct a certain family of pairwise disjoint squares, family K, and corresponding triangles. This is step 4. Okay, so which?
Connected bridge.
Yes, so we construct two bridges are connected if they have a common vertex. So now they appeared connected bridges. So every interior bridge is connected with some exterior bridge, maybe many exterior bridges. So two bridges which one of them is interior, the second one is exterior, we call connected bridges. Okay? So, for every pair of connected bridges, one of them exterior, one of them exterior, one of them interior, we assign in one-to-one way a square K in R2 as follows. So, let me show here AL BL, and this is interior bridge, say L prime BL prime interior bridge, this is corresponding exterior bridge. So this pair, I would like to correspond certain square K in R2. Let me recall that we know from the properties of lacunas that the square from lacuna of the minimum of a minimal diameter QL minimum has a diameter which is equivalent to the distance between LABL. It was one of the properties of lacunas. Because it is equivalent to the diameter of this small island. It was one of the properties of lacunas. So, yes, let me show on true lacunas. Yes, much more. So, for each contacting lacuna, say T Wiggle, we can find in this square QL a certain small square K, which depends on this pair T, T prime, interior bridge and exterior bridge to this lacuna. And the diameter of this square will be equivalent to the diameter of Q minimal. And because of Q minimal contains some dilation of Q minimal contains this small island, it was one of the properties, we know that the same is true for K. We do these things for every contacting lacuna to the lacuna L. Maybe another contacting lacuna, say, lacuna T1, which contacts, again, not lacuna, it's bridge, so lacuna L1 contacts to L. For this lacuna, we again construct its own square K T T1, which have no common points with this. Because the number of contacting lacunas is bounded by some absolute constants, we always can find certain finite number of pairwise disjoint squares which we can correspond to this pairs of lacunas. So we have one-to-one mapping between for connected bridges, between connecting bridges and certain squares which are pairwise disjoint. and have the desired properties that the diameter of K is equivalent to the diameter of corresponding triangle, and some dilation of K contains this triangle. It was one of the requirements in all our stuff. Okay, so this is one-to-one mapping. Can we turn to step five? We now, following all our definitions for this family of squares, K, we construct corresponding families of centers, CK, and corresponding measure, mu, which depends on set E. This is step this is step five. Actually, we have a family K, which I call KE, it depends on E, and corresponding mapping delta, and CE, this is the family of all centers. Actually, it's written on the slide. And we define measure in the same way. Its support belongs to the family of centers, and for every K, measure of the point CK is precisely Menger curvature of the corresponding triangle times to the measure of K. So we have defined measure mu E. We turn to the step six. Now we actually determine so-called important squares. Actually, we now turn to all necessary pre-work for almost optimal decomposition of the Sobolev space L1P and weighted LP space. So we this is actually recalling of the algorithm for determination of these family of squares, so-called important squares. What we do? So we do the following thing. For every square K, and its center CK, we are trying to, by dilation of the square, to construct a square K wiggle so that its measure up to some constant theta is greater than diameter of K wiggle to the power 2 minus P. And whenever we take a certain contraction of this square K, every contraction of square K, alpha K wiggle, whenever alpha is strictly greater than 1, then the measure of this square is strictly less than this number, theta, diameter K wiggle to the power 2 minus P. So this is limited. Ken, yes? Good question. Yes. In this special case, we can begin not from zero. We can begin from the diameter of K. Of K. So it can be proven. So we can prove that the measure of K wiggle with some theta which does not depend only on P is is smaller than yes the diameter. So in this special case, we may begin from the k itself, but with some correction, not one, we take some theta. Okay. So, but in general process, of course, we take ck and we begin from zero our dilation, because we don't know, measure is arbitrary. But for this special case, we can begin from this k, square ck. And we have finite number, by the way, of square, which we can use one of the algorithms. Yeah.
Actually, from 2 and 3, you see that theta is a measure over diameter.
No, theta, it's not measured in hertz. It's some fixed constant.
Every angle, yes. Theta, this constant, is measured over diameter to the power of t minus.
No, no, you... No, if we put instead of k wiggle k, then the measure of u e k, which actually we have only one point, this is the Menger curvature of the square times measure k, should be theta diameter k 2 minus p. Actually diameter to power actually equals to the measure k over diameter k to power p. And so
No,
it's zero. Let me finish, to the power p, of course. And so this inequality is this, yes, equivalent, but actually it is equivalent to the diameter k to power p, this is 1 over r delta, yes, is less than r delta to the power p, which is trivial because it is radius of circle which goes. So from this, only from these considerations we can begin. What continues? This is a discrete measure. So at some point,
is k closed, by the way?
K closed, yes. All squares are closed.
Okay.
So, no.
Now I see.
Yes, so some intersection of two curves. This is measure or growth and this function down. So this is special. Choice of important squares, but it's not important squares, it's some family which contains important squares. And using one of the procedures which I demonstrated days ago, because this number of squares is finite, we can use a very simple procedure of defining of small squares and determining this way important squares. So important squares which we obtain are squares from the family QE, family of important squares. Dilations by a factor of 6, every square, give us a family again of pi by disjoint squares. And for each square K wiggle, there is a certain square K from this family, which belongs to certain dilation, fixing dilation of this square. Okay? So now we turn to the family of centers of important squares. So C wiggle E centers of important squares. Subfamily of our family C. And we turn to Whitney extension method for the set C wiggle E, Whitney lacunary modification of the Whitney extension method. This is step 7, where we determine a corresponding Whitney decomposition and corresponding family of partition of unity. And corresponding family of lacunas for C wiggle E. And all necessary stuff to define lacunary modification of Whitney extension. So we, to every lacuna, we correspond for every lacuna, say this is lacuna this certain square of minimal diameter in lacuna, this is set VL, we construct the so-called projector, which every lacuna corresponds to a point AL, which belongs to the square of the certain dilation of the square of minimal diameter, and this mapping is almost one to one. Every point X has a fixed number of pre-images. So this is certain, instead of the closest point, we choose this point in the Whitney extension method, a certain special way to obtain almost one-to-one mapping. And actually the pre-work at this point is completed. We have prepared all necessary stuff for determining the extension, almost optimal extension. So we turn to definition of the almost optimal extension f of a given function. So actually we shall go in the opposite direction from the last step to the first step. Okay, from values of function to its almost optimal extension. Yeah. Okay, so some philosophy. This algorithm uses only the values of function f on e and all these geometrical objects which we have prepared in the stage of the pre-work. Okay, so we construct the gradient mapping. So we have a function now, as I said. We construct the gradient mapping following using this family K, and of course the family of centers of this family K. This is the first step. We have a family of pi base disjoint squares. It's a certain family of triangles to each K we assign a triangle delta K, and at the center of square K we construct the gradient of the polynomial which interpolates the function f on this triangle, and this is the value of our gradient mapping. It's zero outside of the family of centers. Okay, now we turn to decomposition of this mapping in an almost optimal weight into a Sobolev vector function from L1p and LP function with respect to this weight mu e. All is ready to do this, so we use now the corresponding Whitney extension procedure. Step 2 of the main algorithm. Let me recall how we do this. We to every point from the family of centers, point say actually to for every this is U a certain important square. This is its center. We calculate the average of our function f of our gradient mapping over this square Q. And this is the value of our new mapping tau 1. Tau 1 at point CQ, CQ F, the average of the gradient mapping. Then we extend this mapping, which is defined on centers of important squares, Q prime of important square, and so on. Here we have such this mapping tau 1 wiggle. We extend to all of R2 using the lacunary modification of the Whitney extension method. And here I recalled the formulas, corresponding formulas. So all this stuff is ready for calculation of this extension for each for each square Q which belongs to corresponding for each square Q which belongs to corresponding lacuna L, we assign the same value, the same point AQ for all the lacuna, and calculate the extension using this modification. AQ is the same for all the lacuna. Only this is the difference between standard Whitney extension method. Okay? No, have a question. Yes, the same.
Only related to the centers of the important cubes.
No. Is decomposition of unity of complement of the family of important cubes to R2.
So this is a new because you already had.
Yes, but now we consider only centers of important squares, mm-hmm. and we construct Whitney.
Nothing.
It's certain iterations. And in this way, we obtain the first component of this almost optimal decomposition tau 1. The role of this component actually is the gradient of our extension. Okay, now we do the following. The so-called pre-selection and selection of this certain set value at mapping. Let me explain what I mean. Okay. So, we define the so-called pre-selection of the, yeah.
How much time do you need? Because maybe
you're
right now and you'll continue after that.
I'm very sorry, but we are all tired and I don't know what to do. I actually need 10 minutes, I think maybe 7 minutes to finish this process. I think it will be enough. But maybe people are very tired, I don't know.
How about in 7 minutes, if it isn't done, you take a break of 5 minutes?
Okay, so we are very close to determine the...
We are not in a hurry, I am not in a hurry, but I just want to understand it very well.
Okay, so we define the so-called pre-selection. The mapping G Wiggle, we take the lacuna AL BL, and this point AL we denote G Wiggle T, where T is this interior bridge AL BL to be what is written tau 1 of ALF, certain vector. But I wish to have this vector G-Wiggle which satisfies this equality. Why? Because this vector G will be the gradient of polynomial, and I wish to have this polynomial in such a way that it interpolates our function F on these 2 points, LLBL. But I can guarantee that this vector G Wiggle T F belongs to this line GF, line of all potential gradients of these polynomials. So because of that I call this G Wiggle pre-selection of this vector valuate mapping GF. And the actually last step of all the procedure, from this pre-selection I construct a selection by orthogonal projection of this preselection GV equal TF onto this straight line GFT. So we had certain G wiggle which outside of this line GF, and I take G to be its orthogonal projection. And actually we almost done, because G wiggle will be corresponding jet, the last part of jet. We actually have function, the first part of jet we have. So we now construct corresponding interpolating polynomials. This polynomial, GF all points, GF all point zeta, let me, okay, this all points, this is straight line, all points zeta, such that equality holds. This all potential gradients of polynomial interpolating at these 2 points. And now we do very standard thing, we define polynomial PL, which corresponds to this point x to be, actually I have this on the slide. This is the formula of this polynomial. It has the gradient GTL, and this polynomial interpolates our function f at these 2 points. And that's all. We construct the Whitney extension using these polynomials. Again, we use the lacunary modification to every square q, we assign the, of lacuna l, we assign this polynomial pl. And then we construct function f capital using the modification of Whitney, classical Whitney extension method, and we are done. So thank you for your attention.